Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Paymar, and you are listening to The Big Shift, the podcast that looks at the seismic changes our world and our country confront. Today, we're looking into a subject that is front and center in American society: diversity, equity, and inclusion. The nation was founded on basic principles of liberty, equality, and justice for all. The problem is, America has not lived up to those principles. From the genocide of the Native Americans to hundreds of years of African American slavery, a woman's right to vote and now to choose on pregnancy, to anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant hostility. To explore this critical issue facing our United States that seem more divided than ever is Emil Guillermo, a print and broadcast journalist and commentator who resides in the San Francisco Bay Area. Emil, welcome to The Big Shift. Glad you could find the time.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here with you.
Emil, just for context, you and I worked together some 35 years ago at the NBC television station in San Francisco. I went on to New York and continued broadcasting at CNBC. And Emil, you had an illustrious career as a host of All Things Considered on NPR. You were the first Filipino-American to host a regularly scheduled national news broadcast, as well as writing a column for Asian. Emil, I'm leaving out so many of your accomplishments, but if I listed them all, we'd be here all day.
Well, I thank you for mentioning.
Again, it's been like 35 years since I've seen you. And all of a sudden I get an email invite to come see your one-man play called Emil Amok in the East Village of the New York City. I didn't tell you I was coming. Yeah. And I think you were a bit surprised to see me.
I was. I thought you would. Oh, Jim, I didn't hear from you. He just forgot about me or something. And when I saw you, I really was bugging you and your wife. It was really a great surprise.
If you could take a stab at it, I prefer that you do it. In a nutshell, can you give us a sense of what your one-man play, Emil Amok, is all about?
Well, it really is my story, right? It's my story as a journalist, as a Filipino-American, trying to make it in the mainstream of society. You know, I went to Harvard. How did I get there? And then when you put it in terms of the backdrop of my father and how he came to America, it really tells a story about not just more than immigration, because my father came in 1928. And the thing is, when my father came in 1928, he was a colonized Filipino because the Philippines was a colony of the United States. After the Spanish-American War led into the Filipino-American War, which no one knows about, the Philippine-American War, that's when, after the Spanish-American War, the Spanish sold the Philippines to the U.S., and the U.S. said, well, yeah, we're going to take it over. We believe in American imperialism.
Yeah.
And my father was born under the American flag. He was not a citizen. They wouldn't call him an American citizen. They called him an American national, a Philippine-American national. He was allowed to come here to work, essentially. 1928, when the most Filipino came to the United States.
One takeaway I had from the play, Emil, is how little I really knew about the Philippines, even though I'd spent some time there covering the election of Ferdinand Marcos and Corazon Aquino back in 1986. And I think you were there the previous year, right? Covering the assassination of Benigno Aquino, who was originally going to run against the American-backed dictator Marcos, but he was assassinated before the election, right?
Right. Well, you know, I went there in 83, and this just shows you how the evolution of race and our, you know, consciousness, how it changed in America, or, well, let's just say in our little enclave in San Francisco. There were like hundreds of thousands of Filipinos there. What was happening there was a local story. And in 1983, Aquino was in exile. Benigno Aquino was in exile in America, went back to the Philippines to challenge Marcos, the American-backed dictator, and Aquino was gunned down. Yeah. And it was an assassination. I went to the news director and said, we got to cover this. There are exiles here in America in the Bay Area, and there are Filipino immigrants. This is a local story, and I covered that story in 83. Of course, that's you know, when you saw a million people in Manila, which was really the beginning. It foretold the people power that we would eventually see in 1987 when Corazon Aquino took over.
Getting back to the Philippines for a moment, and you correct me if I'm wrong, if I don't have this right. I mean, it's a country of islands, 7,641 islands, 110 million people, and has only been a free nation for 77 years, I think.
Well, you know, it always has been free, but it... you know, it had this little problem with colonization, the Spanish first several hundred years, and then the United States. And then once the United States figured, oh, we're getting out of the imperializing Asia business, well, at least in the Philippines, then, you know, then the Philippines was free. But how free when you have a dictator? So, I mean, it's a very complex history.
It goes back to 1565, from what I read. It became a colony of Spain. And the name Philippines is derived from King Philip II of Spain. Philippines.
Philippines, right.
Basically, the colony became predominantly Catholic because Spain was spreading Catholicism around the world, including in America. America seized the Philippines during the Spanish-American War, which you mentioned, which was in 1898, and controlled the country until the Japanese Empire invaded in 1942 and took it over in World War II. And then America took the country back in 45, and the following year, 1946, the Philippines finally gained its true independence. So what a turbulent history, Emil.
Oh, yeah. You know, and this was like my father's life really incorporates all of that history, which is why it, you know, it plays a role when I tell my story, because when the Philippines was a colony, he was allowed to come here, but he couldn't own land. He couldn't be a citizen. He couldn't vote, and he couldn't marry. There were anti-intermarriage laws preventing Filipinos for marrying whites, for example, and just in the same way that there were intermarriage laws prevented blacks and other non-whites from marrying whites. But that impacted the Filipinos like my dad. And so when he was here in the 20s, well, you know, he was, you know, a bachelor for the 30s, a bachelor through the 40s, a bachelor through the 50s. And finally, after World War II, my mother worked in Manila as a seamstress, and she would hide under the sewing machine so that she would not be kidnapped or taken by the Japanese soldiers who were occupying Manila at the time. And, you know, they took women and made them into comfort women. You don't really hear their stories very often, but a lot of women came from the Philippines, came to America because they either knew or met American soldiers, or they engaged in, you know, communications with Americans and were allowed to come here. My mother actually came to the United States because a patron of the dress shop was a Spanish patron, brought my mom to San Francisco, and then said, good luck with your life. And she went on to Spain, and my mother was connected with a group of Filipino women here. And that's how she met my dad, who they had the social circles. And that wasn't until the late 50s that I was born. All throughout, you get World War II, and then you have, you know, the what happens to like little Emil Guillermo Jr. as he tries to, you know, navigate his way through American society. Yeah. They didn't know who we were, because Asian Americans, there was no Asian America really to speak of, because there were quotas. Very racist quotas were put on Asian immigration until 1965. And then
especially the Chinese. And then you had the internship Japanese during the war. You know, here's another thing I didn't know, Emil. The Filipinos are the fourth largest foreign-born ethnic group in America. I had no clue about that. After Mexicans, Indians, and Chinese, there are about 4 million Filipinos residing in the U.S., most live on the West Coast, here in New York City and Hawaii. Quite surprised by that number. I mean, having lived in the Bay Area, I know there were a lot of Filipinos in the Bay Area, but around the rest of the country, not such a big presence. But getting back to the whole theme of this podcast, diversity, equity, and inclusion. What was it like for you growing up in a white America. Did you feel the sting of discrimination?
Oh, of course. But, you know, we have learned to deal with it and not focus on the pain so much, but try to transform that. Just you mentioning, you know, how many Filipinos there are. Well, you know, it's because of Catholicism, but it's also because of our long relationship mm-hmm. with America. We've been coming to, we had favored status for a long time to come to America because we were colonized. And then when the floodgates opened up in 1965, because of the immigration law changing, you know, that's when, you know, the Chinese overtook us and the Indians have since overtaken Filipinos in among Asian Americans. You know, Filipinos have been in America for generations. And in fact, the first Filipinos arrived, they didn't settle, but they were in California in 1587. And that's part of the Filipino history that I mentioned in my play. But keep in mind now, though, and to connect with the diversity, inclusion, and equity focus, we don't know this because we don't know the history. And no. If once we understand the history, then everything starts coming, you know, making sense. Oh, this is why there are so many Filipinos.
The Spanish-American War is like a footnote in a history book. I don't think we learned very much at all. Well, we haven't learned very much at all about any of the negative things that have happened in this country. And now you've got people trying to ban books so that we become even less educated. Emil, and I don't need to tell you because you live in the Bay Area, I live in New York. There have been numerous and a lot of vicious anti-Asian attacks in the past several years, particularly after the election of Donald Trump in 2016. In your view, what drives anti-Asian sentiment? And do you think it's getting better or worse?
I think Donald Trump did a lot to fan the flames, you know, when he started using those terms like Kung Flu and China virus. It was anti-Asian, but, you know, no one knows how Asians are divided up. So any kind of Asian will do. They weren't just going after Chinese mm-hmm. because of the, you know, as a scapegoat for the virus because of Wuhan. That, in fact, one of the biggest stories of anti-Asian hate was the Noel Quintana out of New York, who his face was slashed in the subway. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, people I know might remember that story. It was one of the big ones from the pandemic.
Right.
But, you know, this is how the hate has really is varied, you know, from something as vicious as that. There were murders. There are people killed during the pandemic because of this kind of hate. And then there are people who just got the brunt of, you know, epithets and, mm-hmm. you know, people were spat on and people were just looked and frowned upon because they were Asian. And then they, you know, everyone used Asian Americans as a kind of scapegoat because they were following the lead of President Trump. So
do you think it's getting better or worse?
I think it's getting a little better because as people get back out, right, and, you know, they stop wearing masks. Although, you know, I was at a Stop AAPI Hate kind of group meeting where people can share stories of hate and discrimination as a way to help others and, and be more resilient. And I just think that it's getting a little better, but it's still, Asian Americans are still seen as the other. This has been part of our history, whether it's like my father, when he first came here, he was called monkey, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Filipinos who came in the 20s were seen as, oh, you're taking jobs. Now, where have we heard that, right? Mm-hmm. You're taking jobs, you're taking our place. But the special twist for Filipinos in the 20s was they were taking the women. And that's mm-hmm. where the anti-intermarriage laws came in. It wasn't necessarily true with other Asian groups, but because Filipinos spoke English, they had, you know, they were colonized, they thought of themselves as differently from other Asians. There was a lot of anti-Asian or anti-Filipino hate because they were seen with white women. They were seen with blondes mm-hmm. at the dance halls.
Right.
And so this is something, what we've seen the last couple of years because of the pandemic, really nothing new. It's like a revision of all the things that Asian Americans and specifically Filipino Americans have experienced.
You mentioned that you're a graduate of Harvard University, and you've worked at some very high level major market TV stations, and things don't get much better on the radio than NPR. But has it been a struggle for you to climb the ladder of success because you are a Filipino?
Well, I think it's because when you are in it, either you say, I will tell other people's stories gladly. You know, journalism has a mission. Mm-hmm. But when you're in it and understand what isn't said in the mainstream, you find yourself really wanting to tell Asian American or Filipino American stories. Now, mm-hmm. a lot of people who are like me, they'll say, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I'm not Filipino. I'm not Asian. I just give me the stories. I'll tell them. And I could do that. And I did that, but I found that it was easier to make an impact if I could bring my sense of the world and my sense of looking at the world, because there were audience members who were looking at the world my same way. And I could add to what a news program could do, because I can show different stories that would help people understand how we're all in this together. I mean, so I saw that as my role, but a lot of times I couldn't tell those stories as easily. And I really found my voice when I was writing more for ethnic media publications, specifically when I wrote this started writing a column. For Asian Week in San Francisco. I mean, I always wanted to be a columnist, mm-hmm. but because I was in television, people in newspapers would say, oh, you know, you're not a newspaper guy, you're a broadcaster.
Yeah.
And so I actually learned my newspaper chops writing for the ethnic, you know, newspapers in San Francisco and around the country. And then ultimately, I found myself working in mainstream newspapers. Finally, I got a job in Honolulu, where I worked the advertiser, the biggest paper there, then owned by Gannett. Mm-hmm. And I was on the editorial board and had a column. And so I kind of devolved from broadcasting and, you know, from radio. This is all after my radio time at the NPR. Mm-hmm. I found my voice as a writer writing columns about Asian Americans. And I have been, I believe it's the longest running column, my Emil Amok columns that are now at the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, aldef.org.
Tell me about Amok. I mean, yeah. I know what the word Amok means, but why did you put your name with Amok?
Well,
just kind of run wild.
Well, that's sort of what you have to do if you're trying to, or it appears that that's what you do when, you know, you're in the white mainstream and they're not looking at Asian Americans in any kind of way at all. You are really banging the drum and saying, hey, here's some stories. Here's an experience. It's an American experience, and people need to know about this. And Amok was, I just remember, it's always been a word that has fascinated me. And yet you go to people now and you say, do you know Amok? And a lot of people, young people, old people, some people, they'll just say, well, what? You know, they won't know. And it's American, it's English, but its derivation is Malay, Filipino, and it means to be thrust into a murderous frenzy. Now, that is a little...
that's a lot to explain, Emil.
I know, but you know, the thing about Amok is that I use it metaphorically just as an explosion of truth.
Yeah, I got it. Getting back to journalism, I found this stat. The Associated Press reported that 76% of full-time news employees in the United States are, guess,
white.
8% Latino, 7% Black, 6% Asian. News management is 81% white. Now, how important is it to have more ethnic voices in media to tell those stories that are untold?
It's very important, especially in the management classes, because they tend to decide what gets covered and what doesn't. I remember back in the day in the 80s when the assassination of Benigno Aquino took place, I practically had to go with the census to the managers and say, look, this is a local story. Aquino was an exile going back to the Philippines, or exiles here in the Bay Area. You got to send me to cover that story. And they did. If it weren't for a Filipino American like me, people wouldn't have covered that story until much later, three years later, when it was obvious that it was a big story, when the Philippine leadership was threatened, when Marcos was threatened by people power. And so It's very important. And in fact, that those AP stats that you've been mentioning, it was the Association of Newspaper Editors. They've been trying to get the diversity numbers up for the last 30 years. And each year they say, we're going to get it so that the newsrooms will start looking like America. The Asian American number, Asian Americans are 7% of the United States. So, you know, that number seems kind of balanced. But, you know, here's the thing. While we talk about diversity in the news media, look at what's happening to the news media. It's falling apart.
I know.
Newspapers.
It's disappearing. I know. I think something like two newspapers are folded every week in America. Yeah. We've created news deserts now where communities have no news outlets. You recall, and I recall, back in the day in San Francisco, every radio station had a major news department.
Oh, yeah.
Now none of them do. We had two great newspapers. Now there's one, and it's not that great of a newspaper anymore.
It isn't. And, you know, the thing is that there were always little bits of, you know, signs that something was going to change ultimately. But it just took a little longer. Like in the 80s, you could see where, you know, ownership, you know, when we were working at Cron was owned by the Chronicle, and they had radio and TV. And then there was a movement to break it all up. And then they did. And then there was a movement to bring them back together. Now they have duopolies and radio. And
I know.
It's incredible. And you're right. Radio used to be such a force. And now we're doing a podcast because audio is still a force, but through this other digital means. And this is the new... This is the new democratization.
Yeah, but this is also very difficult for people to find.
Exactly.
And to hook onto. For Filipinos, Emil, actually all Pacific Islanders and Asians, what are the barriers to success in the corporate world? Do you feel that we're making progress on diversity, equity, and inclusion?
I'd like to say maybe, but I know in my heart that it's very difficult because it just depends on people's mindsets. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a Filipino American and you feel the pull to do something, you know, for the community, that doesn't necessarily lead you to the corporate boardroom.
No.
You have to. I mean, when I was at Harvard, I remember times when friends of mine, when we were contemplating our futures, a specific friend said, you know, Emil, you ought to go to business school. You ought to. And, you know, here I am 4 years out of, you know, the high school in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my father was a cook. My mother didn't work. Corporate life was not, you know, my idea of anything. I couldn't perceive of myself as anything more than the kind of Filipino that I was. Although I could see that people were going for corporate jobs and MBAs mm-hmm. and law school, but that wasn't me. And mm-hmm. so even though my friend was encouraging me to, why don't you apply for Harvard Business School? But where does a Filipino American kid who thought journalism, my voice, or providing a voice and telling stories, that's where I fit in. So in terms of getting into corporate America, I think now with subsequent generations, you find people saying, yeah, I'll get the corner suite. I'll try my hand at that.
Well, it seems that most companies, the HR units, are looking for ways to include more minorities in their workforce to promote them to higher positions. At least that's what I read about in, you know, the Journal or the Financial Times, Fortune. Do you believe that to be the case? And how much more needs to be done to kind of equal things out, level the playing field?
Well, whatever they're doing, they need to do more. You know, I mean, I always constantly read about people just from alumni journals and whatnot. You know, here's an Asian American. Here's a, you know, in law. Here's an Asian American in business. And I applaud that. Everyone, you know, should be able to pursue their dream, however they conceive it. And they should not be stopped. I mean, we had a great story the other day when Stuart Rhodes of Proud Boys was handed down an 18-year sentence, you know, for what he did on January 6th. And who was the judge who read him the riot act, you know, so to speak, on what it means to be an American and what he did to really supplant, you know, democracy. But it was an Asian American, Asian Indian judge, Amit Mehta. I thought that was so great to see. And, you know, there are Asian judge like Mehta, Chinese, Indian, Filipino, but you got to get them in the pipeline and you got to give them an opportunity. So everything that they're, anything that they're doing now in the corporate world, they got to redouble and do more.
You know, I mentioned at the beginning that the United States seems more divided than ever, perhaps as divided as we were during the Vietnam War. I hope we don't get to the point of civil war. You stated that the only way toward kind of a sense of unity in this country is by knowing each other's stories. And with the lack of minorities in the news business, how are we ever going to get those stories told?
Well, the story, we got to deal with the stories that do seep in. And then we have to seek out these stories and seek out the people who are telling these stories. I just know that I told a story just this past week, and I was in Oakland talking about a story when I was a kid and how I shared a locker with this African-American guy and, you know, a gym locker. So we'd seen each other dress for gym and undress for gym, and later on in the summer, we encountered each other in the neighborhood, and I was selling firecrackers, and he was part of some group that didn't like us going into their neighborhood, and they chased us and wanted to steal our firecrackers. We were all of 12, and I went up the stairs of house to hide behind a big fern, and I heard some guy come up, and he started wailing at me. And he was beating me up. And then I looked through my hands. I was shielding my face. And it was my locker mate. He was beating the heck out of me. And he saw me. And he pulled his punch because we knew each other.
Yeah.
And he went down the steps and, you know, went off with his gang.
Back when we kind of began this conversation, Emil, we talked about the fact that we were both over in the Philippines during, you know, the very tumultuous years of Benigno Aquino and Ferdinand Marcos, and then Benigno's wife becoming the president. And then you end up just a few years ago with Rodrigo Duterte, who was brutalizing people and extrajudicial killings, and he is no longer in power. But Ferdinand Marcos's son is now the president of the Philippines.
Jim, this is the theme of succession just broadens out and includes not just the corporate American world, but also I was doing a show the other day, and I said, are the Marcos the Roy family? Is that the Filipino succession where, you know, you could be the disgraced dictator and then plot your comeback, and now you're the new, he's not dictator, but he's the new president.
And what do you think about the way that we seem to be transitioning geopolitically, at least the Philippines? Under Duterte was moving toward China and away from the United States. Now that seems to have turned around.
Yeah, well, look, it's not, we're on shifting sands, as they say, right? I mean, it's always, we have to be flexible, and the fight is always moving, and you're not like stationary, like Rock'em Sock'em robots. You're moving around, you know, the canvas as things happen. So yes, under Duterte, the Philippines was saying nasty things to Obama, saying nasty things to Trump, cozying up not just to the Chinese but also to Russia, and now then they were, you know, pro Chinese for a while, and then, you know, there was this idea that the China in the Western Philippine Sea was going in the Spratly Islands, and they were beating their chest, and they were going to take over the South, you know, the Western Philippine Sea, and incorporate it into part of their thing, and they were actually taking over some of those islands there,
and building islands.
they were building on the Spratlys and the neighboring islands, and now, right, with the, you know, what do we have? When I was in New York, they had the balloon story, the China balloon, and now everyone is looking at China in this, you know, jaundiced way because, oh, you know, president for life. And what are we going to do? And now, you know, the U.S. has opened up those diplomatic channels with the Philippines and the Philippines, because we need each other, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The Philippines need the U.S. And it almost goes back to why we had, you know, the relationship from the colonization to, you know, World War II, when the U.S. really allowed the Filipinos to have their independence. And you know what? Why? the U.S. let the Philippines become independent. It's because there were white nationalists in the United States who were angered at the Filipinos who were in California.
And because
of, you know, things like, oh, they're stealing our jobs, they're stealing our women, there was a real backlash against Filipinos. And the deal was, okay, you Philippine nationalists in the Philippines, we'll give you your independence. You take these guys back.
white supremacy and white nationalism thrive in America today. You know, one final thought, Emil.
Yeah.
AI. Artificial intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
Some suggest it could mean the end of honest journalism. I don't think any of us know where this new technology is leading us, but AI knows how to write a story using machine learning, but it lacks human experience. I mean, what do you think the threat is?
The threat is real emotion. You know, the threat is humanity. I believe where the AI folks said that this is an existential threat to humanity. I believe them. They're almost like these mad scientists saying, "Stop me before I kill again." You know.
Yeah.
It's almost like. But here's the thing: out of all the people who signed that statement saying this is an existential threat, one of the people who didn't sign was Bill Gates. My classmate.
Really?
Harvard. Yeah.
He did.
Well, he was in the same class. He dropped out. I graduated. So I guess I showed him. But here's the thing about Gates. Gates did not sign it because, of course, he's the guy who forced everyone to take Internet Explorer. He's the monopolist who's made all the money and now he's giving it away. He wants people to make the money off of AI. And if you've owned NVIDIA stock, you know, it's been astronomical. People are making money off this stuff. And this is the thing about, you know, the council that put out the statement. It's almost like the beef council saying, hey, you're not going to get a heart attack from eating steak. Or the pork council saying, oh, you're fat. Oh, you get a little bit of fat. It's going to hurt your cholesterol. And that's what they did when they put out that statement. They still want to make the money.
Well, the one thing I keep thinking about when I think about AI is 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
He keeps saying, Hal, open the pod bay doors. And the machine that was controlling the spaceship said, sorry, I can't do that. And that's how I see AI. But Emil, as usual, there's never enough time and we could go on and on, but we have to kind of end things here. I want to thank you so much for taking time today. Always enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, same here, Jim. So much to talk about.
That was Emil Guillermo, a veteran journalist, public speaker on race and diversity. He hosts the PETA podcast and a daily live news talk show on YouTube. And you can find Emil's work. Now just take out a pen and paper. I'll give you a split second and Google Emil Guillermo, and you'll be able to see more about his accomplished career and listen to his programs. I'm Jim Paymar, and you have been listening to The Big Shift, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening today, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Big Shift that's coming soon.